Getting the order, my bill up first. Must be a good bill. I wonder if I have my testifier here. She was going downstairs to look for it. Yeah, she's here.
Good morning, Representative Gunther.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. I move House File 984 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Mr. Chairman, members, 984 is Boys and Girls Club. It was brought to me by my good friend, the Senate Chairman, Dallas Sams, and he said that he really wanted this funded. So I'm very focused on getting this done. This bill appropriates $1 million from the dislocated workers' funds. It is an appropriate use of those funds, I found out. And with that, I would very much like to have our testifiers tell you about the exciting program.
Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Eric Christensen.
Please proceed.
2 years ago, I didn't think that I would even graduate from high school. But today, I'm going to school for web page design at the Technical College. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is Eric Christensen. On June 6, 1996, I became a proud member of the Eastside Boys and Girls Club in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And it is my pleasure to represent the Boys and Girls Clubs of Central Minnesota in this morning's hearing as a Youth of the Year for 2004. Most kids are able to take school for granted. Most kids just assume that they're going to graduate from high school. I learned early on that I'm not most kids. I was 4 years old when my father left. He rushed to marry my mother and just wasn't able to handle the responsibilities of being a father. Growing up, I might have seen him 3 times a year. He would show up out of nowhere to take me out to dinner and buy me things. He thought that was enough. Never once did he make an effort just to be there for me. I wish he wasn't a stranger in my life. I'd give back everything he ever bought me just to have him as a role model in my life. Just to be like every other kid and have a dad. As a young child going to school, I learned what it felt like to be different and unwelcome long before I knew what it was like to be embraced and accepted. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that I think it is wrong to be different. Being a unique individual is one of the greatest gifts a person has. It is, however, wrong to be made to feel like you are less of a person because you are different from those around you. My life changed forever on Tuesday, June 6, 1996. That was the first time I came to the Boys and Girls Club. For the first time in my life, I found a place I truly belonged. For me, the club will always be an environment where people of all backgrounds are accepted for who they are and not what they look like, for who they can be and not because of where they came from. The staff of the club gave a lot of themselves to help me deal with the difficulties I was encountering. For the first time in my life, I consistently had positive role models. Until March 3rd, 2004, I had never been to a dentist before. My family has health and dental insurance provided by the state. Unfortunately, it is difficult to find a dentist who is either accepting new patients or willing to take RSA coverage. When Joy Milburn, the director of the Eastside Boys and Girls Club in St. Cloud, learned of this, she offered to find me a dentist who would accept my insurance. I've always known that brushing and flossing my teeth was the right thing to do. But early in my life, I lacked the role models needed to reinforce these behaviors. Since my teeth were not in a good condition, I was concerned that the dentist would criticize me for what I had failed to do. After 4 successful dentist visits, I would like to thank Dr. Nguyen of the Smile Center in Big Lake, Minnesota, and the Boys and Girls Club for giving me a brand new smile and second chance to take care of my teeth. A year and a half ago, I was given the opportunity to be a junior staff member at the Boys and Girls Club. This is very significant to me because it gives me a chance to become a better role model to younger members, and it teaches me to handle greater responsibility. The other staff were a great support system to me, teaching me the basics of being a reliable staff. I learned the importance of being on time every day, wearing a clean shirt to work, and to leave personal stress at the door. Last February, I celebrated my 18th birthday. I chose to spend the evening at the club performing my responsibilities as a junior staff member. For the most part, it was a typical shift. However, at the end of the night, I was called into the rec area. To my surprise, all my coworkers were gathered around a cake that read "Happy 18th Birthday." As they sang "Happy Birthday" to me, I made a wish and blew up the candles. That was the first birthday wish I ever got to make because I had never had a birthday cake before. If you were to ask me 2 years ago if I was going to finish high school and attend college, the answer probably would have been no. As you can see, the answer to that question today is a resounding yes. They forced me down a path I didn't want to be on. They just gave me some options. Options I wouldn't have had if I wasn't a member of the Boys and Girls Club. I thought about it, and I made my decision. The decision here has not been easy. When I first asked my school counselor if it was possible for me to graduate with my class, she said no. That answer simply wasn't good enough for me. Last school year, I overloaded my class schedule, attended regular classes every day, and went to night school every other day. I even completed night school a month and a half early. I had sacrificed a lot to get here, but it has been the most worthwhile experience that I have ever been through. I am proud to say that I'm the first person on either side of my family to attend college. It is just as difficult as I expected, but the staff here at the club and at the technical college are helping me get through it, step by step. I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for the Boys and Girls Club. The club has given me a place to belong, helped me graduate from high school and attend college, and has given me the confidence.
Yeah. Any questions from the members?
Any further questions? Pretty effective and powerful testimony.
I try.
And Mr. Sherry's not even lower yet.
I'm getting there.
Okay. With that, Representative Gunther renews his motion for House File 984 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Zolka?
Yep.
Good morning, Representative Gazalka.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1536 for possible inclusion in the jobs omnibus bill.
Actually, Representative Gazalka, my understanding is that your House File needs to go to civil law.
Is that right?
So Representative Gazalka moves House File 1536 to the civil law for approval to pass and be approved to the Civil Law Committee.
Before we begin, I've got a couple technical oral amendments that I'd like to make that Mr. Soderberg pointed out to me. On page 6, line 35, that's where it says 70, it should read 80.
Again, that was on page...
Page 6, line 35, where it says $70, it should read 80. And on page 7, line 15, where it reads $20, it should read $40.
Is there, Any discussion on the oral amendment by Representative Gazalka? Question for staff. Does the oral amendment affect the fiscal amount that's been supplied? No? Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members, no, it just brings the bill into what the intention was originally. So the fiscal note is reflecting the oral amendment having been incorporated.
Thank you. Any further discussion regarding the amendment? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes. Representative Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I was approached maybe a month ago by representatives of this group and gave their case to me, and as a freshman, you know, I get to hear all kinds of new ideas, and I felt like they had a compelling case that deserved to be heard. They want to continue to provide displaced homemaker resources to those individuals so that they can get back on their feet. As you're all aware, the governor is proposing cutting this program and combining it with the displaced workers program. Again, I said I felt that they deserve a right to plead their case and why this should remain separate. Let me just say this. I think many of the individuals that we can help in this area sacrifice careers to raise families. And I think that is one of the highest callings that men or women can have. And when they've given that up and something doesn't turn out the way they want it to, and we have an opportunity to get them back on their feet, then I think we should at least give that serious consideration. I believe healthy families are the backbone of a healthy society, and so whatever we can do, we should. But so with that, I want them to plead their case, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Susan Brock. And I am the executive director at LifeWork Planning Center, one of the six contractees with this department to provide displaced homemaker program services. Representative Gunther, members of the committee, before I begin, I would like to acknowledge the displaced homemakers who have traveled here from around the state to be with us this morning. If you'd all please stand for just a moment. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and particularly thanks to Representative Gazalka and to all of the other co-authors of House File 1536 on the committee, Nelson, Ruth, Sertich, Slawick, Kirk, Clark, and Mahoney. To recognize the importance of this program, this legislation has the authorship from the chairs of the Health Policy and Finance Committee, Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee, Transportation Finance Committee, and both the Speaker and Minority Leader in the House. In the Senate, we have the authorship from the chairs of the Senate Environmental, Agricultural, and Economic Budget Division, Jobs Energy Committee, Public Safety Budget Division, Finance Committee, President of the Senate, and Majority Leader. This clearly demonstrates the importance of the Displaced Homemaker Program and that legislators understand how this program helps their constituents in their district. We are proposing funding from marriage license and divorce fees because the governor has eliminated the Displaced Homemaker Program in his budget, including recommending the revocation of the $10 marriage license fee increase from the 2003 session. This would be a budget-neutral recommendation. The $750,000 would be returned to the budget to the Workforce Development Fund to be used to support other programs and would not be a savings for the taxpayers in Minnesota. In his testimony before the Joint Committee, Commissioner Kramer stated that the Displaced Homemaker Program is, quote, intriguing. In fact, this program is effective, performance-based, and cost-effective. And rather than proposing the elimination of this program, it would make sense to recognize it for the exceptional model that it is. The Displaced Homemaker Program is a safety net for women who have chosen with their families that their career is in the home. Without the Displaced Homemaker Program, these women would fall between the cracks. The Displaced Homemaker Program is the economic cornerstone of the three pillars of women's safety and security, along with sexual assault programs and domestic violence programs. Displaced homemakers are unique, with a unique set of challenges, needs, and barriers. A disproportionate number, although data is not collected on this, are experienced as service providers is that between 50 and 75% are survivors of physical and or sexual abuse. Displaced homemakers are displaced for reasons generally not of their own choosing, but because they have been abandoned, separated, divorced, widowed, or have a disabled spouse, and they are almost always emotionally and psychologically devastated. This requires solutions that are very different than what is appropriate for the traditional male dislocated worker. Displaced homemakers face special barriers to rebuilding shattered lives, which must be rebuilt before they can become productive workers. Although more women are in the workforce, the reality is that displaced homemakers still require specialized services in their transition to self-reliance for themselves and their families, and that the life events that create displaced homemakers have certainly not gone away. Displaced homemakers are not incumbent workers. They are not eligible for unemployment or reemployment insurance, and although they have always been eligible under the federal dislocated worker definition, at the Minnesota state level, they have been held at the lowest level to be served. Historically, very few receive dislocated worker services. Displaced homemakers are primarily older women. 52% are 40 years old or older, and two-thirds are over 35 years of age. 98% are female, and it's interesting to note that the 2% of male displaced homemakers that have served have doubled in the last biennium. In the 2004 program year, only 6% were served by both displaced homemaker programs and WIA, and only 26% were served both by the displaced homemaker program and MFIP. The Displaced Homemaker Program is a pre-employment program that has always exceeded the standards the department has set for positive outcomes. Last year, this program achieved 82% positive outcomes as defined by Minnesota DEED, which set a standard of 75%. Although the results for participants entering employment are also very significant and impressive, 30% at an average wage of $11.06 an hour, which is $2 higher than an MFIP average wage. Commissioner Kramer suggests that the needs of displaced homemakers can be met under the dislocated worker program at the workforce centers. Why is this not plausible? Because displaced homemakers are multivariate and need intensive services that are not met at the computer terminal. Displaced homemaker programs are established programs in the nonprofit sector and are experienced in meeting the special need of displaced homemakers and are passionate about serving women in transition. It would be extremely costly to replicate the displaced homemaker program within the workforce centers. Yesterday, late, we received a request from our contact in the department to, quote, go easy on the workforce centers today. I want to be clear that the Displaced Homemaker Program has no personal agenda against the workforce centers, with whom we have established many healthy and excellent working relationships and friendships, and that we would certainly not want to jeopardize those. In fact, two of the remaining six Displaced Homemaker Programs are housed in the workforce centers. But I must tell the truth, and the workforce centers have sustained many funding cutbacks. Especially in a time of funding cutbacks and dwindling resources, it's not a good time to add a new program there. Most workforce centers have experienced changes and cutbacks in their staffing, and more are expected. With the workforce service areas taking on a larger responsibility, this will result in even less opportunity for services to multivariate folks such as displaced homemakers. WSAs, which operate both WIA and MFIP programs in many cases, function under strict performance standards that leave staff that must focus on the most readily employable and trainable. Staff that lack expertise in the pre-employment needs facing displaced homemakers and whose time demands are already extensive. A displaced homemaker needs extensive services. The remaining displaced homemaker programs, as I have said, have excellent working relationships and collaborations with many of the workforce centers. In fact, many workforce centers refer to the displaced homemaker program for women and men whom they see as having extensive barriers and needing the specialized services displaced homemakers programs provide as the first steps toward economic independence. Steve's focus and primary cluster is the business and employer community, not the job seeker, and especially not job seekers with an exacerbated set of barriers and needs. Workforce centers are also dealing with their own trend to regionalization and virtual or computer centers, especially in rural areas, where the displaced homemaker program is oftentimes the only game in town for the working poor, especially with Saturday and evening hours in rural and exurban areas. Displaced homemakers' first focus is on customized pre-employment services, the preparation of the homemaker to make the necessary life adjustments, address their unique career development barriers, engage in a tailor-made career development process, and develop a life plan for self-sufficiency. In an already overloaded workforce center system, it's simply unrealistic to add another target audience with multiple barriers and to expect that their needs will be met, especially with those strict performance standards. Displaced homemaker programs have developed an extraordinary and cost-effective network of community partnerships with cash and in-kind match from other nonprofits, including homeless shelters and domestic violence programs, private foundations, some businesses, and churches. Displaced homemaker programs have established significant linkages and partnerships with church and faith-based organizations, including collaborative workshop series and other services, special social justice collections and contributions, adopt a family and adopt a homemaker worker project, representation on displaced homemaker program boards and other volunteer work, free space, publicity through church publications and websites, printing and copying, clerical and pastoral services, assistance with local outreach and community connections, and all this generates substantial goodwill in congregations and communities. Displaced homemakers form, on average, a minimum of 7 faith-based partnerships per year, per program. In fact, 2 of the displaced homemaker program directors have degrees in ministries. And finally, I would like to remind you of the deep and wide bipartisan support in both houses. And now, Kim Pilgrim will share with you a customer satisfaction testimony from Andy Therrien, who had planned to be with us this morning, but unfortunately is ill with pneumonia and unable to join us.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Kimberly Pilgrim, representative, committee. 3 years ago, my husband phoned me from work and informed me he couldn't do this anymore. This turned out to be our marriage. The phone call was the end of 30 years of life together. All I'd ever wanted to be, all I ever was ended. 30 years of down the drain. Everything I wanted to be, everything I was a homemaker. And I was a good one. Our daughter grew up well with high values, high set of standards. We were healthy, frugal, kind people, honest, tax-paying, voting citizens, considerate neighbors, plain good people. The stunning, painful shock of this abrupt divorce was accompanied by an incapacitating despair regarding the rest of my life. I was utterly incapable of supporting myself. I had no marketable skills. At 52, I couldn't expect to go back to school and still have years enough to develop a lucrative career. Good heavens, I live in Duluth, a university town full of fresh, bright, young competition. I started thinking I'd rather die than lose my lifestyle, my home, my dignity. End up living in a cardboard box in an alley somewhere. Depression and worthlessness swallowed me as I realized that all that I had been to our family and to my husband was suddenly worth nothing. I became very ill and was forced to see my doctor. And during the visit, God bless her, she told me about the Displaced Homemaker Program. Although I didn't believe this program could really help me, I checked it out and applied. It began with a methodical personal assessment. What were my interests? What type of activities had I always enjoyed? What abilities do I have that I've dismissed or overlooked? After much study, I chose my dream job, computer network administration. The Displaced Homemaker Program then had me develop a plan of action that would ready me for my dream job, the plan. I'd enroll in an accelerated program, networking program, try that more than once in a lifetime. I'd apply for any computer jobs if only for the experience of writing resumes. If by 3 months after graduation I didn't find a job, I'd either volunteer my skills to a charity that needed computer help, or I'd look for a stopgap job. A good job history shows a potential employer that I'm a stable employee with a good work ethic. And I would network. My computer program's internship was with the Boys and Girls Club of Duluth. Later I found a non-computer job, and it was a good paying job with the EPA in Duluth as a security guard. That job paid $12 an hour. A major part of the displaced troublemaker program concerns were how and where to look for good jobs. But it also stressed that many, many jobs are acquired through networking. So I imposed on my friends to keep an ear open for any computer-related job openings that they might hear about. I asked everyone I met if they knew of anything. A friend of mine knows the state director of development of a certain company. My friend mentioned me to her. The director called me, suggesting that I apply for a job with the company in Duluth. Then the director herself recommended me to the company. I now called upon the skills that I had learned in the Displaced Toolmakers program. I fine-tuned my resume, wrote a clean, positive application, dressed up, and gave my best interview. Thanks to what I learned in the Displaced Toolmaker program, I am not on any welfare roll, not drawing state funds through Medicare. I am not living in a cardboard box. I am not a thief or any kind of criminal, not a druggie, and not a bitter, angry victim. Thanks to the DH programs, I am the computer network administrator for a company in Duluth, Minnesota, currently making $15 an hour. I was hired with the understanding that this job could lead to employment on the state level, a full-time job with competitive salary and benefits. I withheld the name of the employer's name out of courtesy of them and not to jeopardize that last step in my goal of full self-sufficiency. I want to make that last step because I'm a valuable worker, not because I got to tell my story and testimony at the Capitol. I know you must prioritize many programs in terms of efficient dollars, yet you also have a mandate to fund programs that provide for the safety and well-being of citizens who cannot or do not know how to help themselves. The DH program satisfies both these mandates. It's a proven method that fosters the self-sufficiencies of persons who are facing hopelessness and destitution, but it is also a great investment in terms of recaptured expenses. Compare the cost of a 6 to 10 week program with the tax revenues from the adult worker for the rest of their life. Compare the low cost of a short-term but effective displaced homemaker program versus the huge and rising costs of Medicaid and welfare for 5 years, not to mention the cost of a high risk of falling into drugs, crime, or violent victimization. I hope my story gives you an idea how powerful the DH programs are. I owe this program an enormous debt of gratitude, and that's why I'm telling my story, to ask you to give many other displaced homemakers my same great opportunity to develop their very real potential as productive citizens, workers, and taxpayers. Thank you for the honor and privilege of giving this testimony to this committee.
Thank you.
My name is Daniel Swam, and I am the Executive Director of Career Solutions, Incorporated. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding the Minnesota Displaced Homemaker Program. Displaced Homemaker programs provide pre-employment career counseling services, which allow individuals to improve their career and educational opportunities. The Displaced Homemaker Program provides this legislature with the opportunity to make a strategic workforce investment. As workforce development systems become more streamlined and focused, the Displaced Homemaker Program delivers a service that meets the needs of career changers and employers as well. According to the National Council for Adult and Experiential Learning, Career development services play an increasingly important role in who businesses recruit and retain as employees. They found that customized pre-employment career counseling and career planning workshops, core services provided by the Displaced Homemaker Program, have between 14% and 19% better efficacy than programs that use the Career Resource Center model, such as is used by the workforce centers. The strategic investment of resources in pre-employment career development services, like the Displaced Homemaker Program, also have the bonus effect of lowering employers' recruitment and retention costs. Displaced Homemaker Programs provide a focused and effective investment of Minnesota's workforce development revenues and resources. The changing nature of the employment contract places higher expectations on individuals for the quality of their work. The ability to competently and effectively self-manage one's career is fundamental to achieving success in the contemporary economy. Simply put, finding a good job at a livable wage depends on a person's ability to make informed and considered career decisions. By providing this at-risk population with targeted resources for addressing their unique career development barriers, Displaced Homemaker Programs deliver each individual client a tailor-made career development service that has been proven to result in higher levels of employee-employer job satisfaction, increased income and benefits, lower job turnover, and longer employee job stability. As human resources professionals will attest, the one-size-fits-all approach to employee development simply does not work. Instead, targeted strategies where individuals have access to customized services, including vocational assessment, workforce development training seminars, and career coaching, such as those provided by the Minnesota Displaced Homemaker Programs, are consistently demonstrated to achieve the highest levels of customer satisfaction. The Displaced Homemaker Program, as presently administered by community-based organizations, provides a high-quality, cost-effective, an accountably managed service delivery network that ensures that this vulnerable, at-risk cohort, the majority of whom are females between the ages of 40 and 60, and who face a radical occupational reorientation in a time of crisis without the support of spouse or family, are ensured equal opportunity and equal access to the resources they need in order to advance and thrive in their new careers. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this concludes our remarks supporting the continuation of funding for the Minnesota Displaced Homemaker Program. On behalf of the Displaced Homemakers of Minnesota, we thank you.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To anyone who would like to answer these questions, you say very few refuse dislocated worker services. Can you explain that?
Well, I'll answer that because I think it was my statement.
I think it was.
I may have misstated. If I stated it as you did, I did misstate. You said very few refuse?
No, I said very few
receive. Receive? Okay, very few do indeed receive dislocated worker services. Last year, out of 1,025 displaced homemakers served, only 6% were co-enrolled in the WIA program.
What programs are they enrolled in?
I couldn't tell you that. whether they were enrolled with training dollars or not, because the department data couldn't allow us to pull that out. In fact, it was support from within the department that suggested that we do that computer run to identify whether or not there was significant duplication with MFIP services and WIA mm-hmm. services. And they did that run, and they found that there was only a 6% overlap. They don't carry the the data on exactly which services they receive. And what I can tell you is that in 21 years of working with these programs, I have consistently seen that displaced homemakers are not eligible for dislocated worker training dollars. And
they don't need training?
They are eligible under the federal definition. They have always been eligible under the federal definition, and sometimes they're under the have been eligible under the Minnesota state definition, but not always. But even when they are eligible under both those definitions, they are at the very bottom of the ladder, and they are the very last to be served, and their needs aren't met until all the other categories are served first, which results in almost no displaced homemakers receiving those services.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're telling me that they don't receive those services because they aren't eligible for training. Is that right?
No, I'm telling you that I do not understand exactly why so few have received those services through the dislocated worker program. The only reason we have been given is that the displaced homemakers are at the very bottom of the ladder, and they've not received the services.
Representative
Chairman, I certainly listened to this program. Wonderful testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Representative Gunther. This is, I guess I just feel compelled to share my experience in the area that I serve, which is the Brainerd, Todd County, Wadena County area, which is the poorest pocket in the state.
Everybody thinks it comes from the poorest pocket in the state.
But it is. Todd County is the poorest county in the state.
Okay.
Okay.
I trust you.
And the workforce centers in that area have a limited amount of dislocated worker dollars, and what we've noticed is there have been a lot of layoffs, and the workers that have been laid off, let's say for example from Potlatch, they receive the money from the pot first. So now when we have a woman that stayed at home for 25 years and they're going to train her to make the exact same amount of money that she did in her previous employment, which is zero, they go, well, here's the computer, and there's McDonald's, and they'll help you write a resume. That's been my experience with the people that I work with that have went to the workforce center. So what we do is we give them the pre-employment training and the skills that they need, and then we take them to the workforce center when they're ready, and then they receive the training if there's any money left.
Potlatch got special money from the federal government, so that didn't interfere with their state allocated amount of dislocated worker funds that the workforce centers got. So that was a special case. Potlatch did get extra federal money.
Right.
So it did not interfere with the normal allocation for the workforce centers in those areas. At least I didn't think so. It's not supposed to.
Well, I guess I was just using the Potlatch as an example.
Okay. Could you help me out and tell me if you didn't get job trainings, money, and help from dislocated workers, where did you get your work, job training from?
If I may answer that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, during the Ventura administration, I believe there was a special allocation that was made by the legislature at that time to provide specific training monies for displaced homemakers through the state displaced homemaker program, and I believe that lasted for one biennium.
So that's where she got the money. Where did she get her training from?
Are you addressing that question to me, sir?
You assumed to answer her questions before I assumed you were doing it again.
Well, I was answering in general regarding where the displaced homemaker program received. We had a special allocation at one time that we don't have anymore.
I'm aware of that one. Yeah, thank you. Where did this program, where did you get your training from to get your job? From the employer that hired you, or where?
Ms. Butler.
Now, are you, is the question in regards to the testimony?
Well, do you have a job now?
Yes, I do.
Where did you get your training for that job?
I work for the Minnesota Displaced Homemaker Program.
You work for the program?
Yes.
So they trained you, okay.
Sorry. I think, Mr.
Let's talk about positive outcomes. You mentioned those. Positive outcomes is something I'm very interested in. Since very few people take advantage of or receive dislocated worker services, can you tell me about these positive outcomes and what regard to what fashion they take?
That's fair.
I can address that. You want me to go through all of the positive outcomes?
Well, just some examples. I'm curious.
Okay. Well,
I've gone to several dislocated workers meetings, so I've been there. So
I know you're one of the very few legislators that has visited a displaced homemaker program, so you have a very good sense of them. The types of terminations that occur that are positive outcomes under the deed guidelines for the displaced homemaker programs include employment, full or part-time, employment combined with education, remedial education, which includes ESL, GED, or adult basic education, certificate programs, which are under 2 years, which account for only 6.5% of the terminations, and degree programs, which are 2 or more years, which account for 4% of the terminations. And I would just have to say that, well, I'll come back to that. The next category is active with another program, such as MFIP-WIA or rehabilitation services, and we do refer a lot of our participants to rehabilitation services, because when we combine the data of the displaced homemakers themselves who have a disability or who have a disability within their family, I think that's between 23% and 24% of displaced homemakers are also coping with the disability in the family. And the final category of positive termination is completed program objective, and that means that they have accomplished the goals outlined in their employment plan. Examples, do you want me to continue with some more?
Well, I was just interested in what you consider a positive outcome. They get a job or...
They get a job and go to school, and that's how most of them do indeed finance their educations. Of those 10.5% who did some post-secondary or continuing education, most of them finance them by juggling the multiple priorities of continuing to be full-time homemakers and single parents and caring for their families, of working at least part-time, sometimes on a full-time basis, and of attending school on a full or part-time basis. It's exhausting, but it's possible.
Thank you.
Representative Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming this bill's coming back to this committee once it makes its rounds. Okay. I've talked to Representative Gazelka about this, and Mr. Swam provided some data for me, but the one thing that I really object to in here is increasing the fees on marriage licenses. I don't like putting additional barriers in the way of marriage, and then I think maybe we should just make it up on the marriage dissolution fee. And so Mr. Swam has provided me some data on what it would be to just totally fund the program through the marriage dissolution fee, and that would be my preference. And I don't have an amendment today, but I intend to work with the author on that. But I just kind of want to put that out on the table.
Representative, please.
Representative Welcome, Chair Gunther.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Garofalo. Did
Very
I get
good.
That right?
Yes, good. I'm impressed.
Good point.
While I understand and believe that it's a logical and reasonable plan that this program would be funded from fees from those who need it, I need to offer a few words of explanation here. Because many displaced homemakers, I don't think it would be reasonable to fund this totally on dissolution filing fees, because most displaced homemakers become displaced homemakers for reasons other than divorce. In fact, I checked the data recently, and for last year, 38% of our displaced homemakers that we served entered the program because they were divorced. The rest were widowed, abandoned, separated, or had a disabled partner or other family member upon whom they had formerly relied for the family economic sustenance. So, you know, I think that that user fee tracks well with the plan that we have in place, because that's 38%, and as we have projected the numbers, 36% of our funding would be coming from dissolution filing fees, as is proposed in Senate File 1536.
Representative Surge.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Representative Welcome, I'm sorry.
Just one more thing. Ma'am, I understand that, and actually my first legislative assistant when I started at the legislature here came through the program, and her husband had been murdered out of state. But I think when we tax something or fee something or whatever, you're getting less of it. And I want that the encouragement of the state to be on marriage and against divorce. And that's the purpose, not that it perfectly matches up. That's not my intent, because I know we can't do that. But the people who are getting married aren't necessarily the problem. It's people that are getting divorced or other things happening, and that's where I think the bias should be.
Representative Zolkin.
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, I appreciate and agree with you that marriage is the number one thing that we need to hold up, and I think we need to talk about it later, and I appreciate the wanting to have more dialogue.
Thank you.
Representative Surtich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to talk a bit about the funding as well. The other thing I think we need to be careful of when we're talking about this, coming from a single guy here that probably shouldn't, but there are folks that are in abusive relationships and those sorts of marriages as well that I think we need to not make too big of a barrier for them to get out of it as well. So I appreciate your opinion on that. We need to have that discussion. I just want to go back to what we were talking about today, and what actually Representative Gunther was talking about was how this was funded in the past, previous to many of us being in this committee and knowing the history of it. It was originally a general fund initiative. Then it got switched over to the dislocated worker fund, and now we're looking at a fee structure again. So I think looking at how we fund this is important, and I appreciate you bringing it forward, Representative Gazelka, because it's successful, and I think that's why we have to have the discussion on where we fund it and where we fund things that are successful. But my question really is to the issue of the governor not funding this. I don't think the governor's, and when I remember the commissioner being before the committee, he didn't say that this didn't work or that we didn't have enough money for it. He said that it wasn't at the core mission of the department or something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing there, and I apologize for that. So to any of the testifiers, can you speak to that? Because we're going to be hopefully voting on this and reinstituting an initiative that works well. Can we discuss, because it will still be under the department's purview, we're just funding it differently, can we discuss that aspect of it? Because I think that's what the committee ultimately has to decide, is this under the purview, are we putting it in the right place, and then also discussing the funding structure. So can we speak to first the success of it and why you feel it should be continued under DEED and in a worthwhile initiative?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Surge, this program was and shall continue to be an odd duck, which is, I think, why there is a lot of confusion and discussion about this program. now and probably forever shall be. That does not change the fact that this is one of the most cost-effective programs that the state has. It is one of the most efficient programs that the state has, and it is certainly to the core of the mission of the department, which is to prepare a workforce that is competitive and efficient and can compete in a world economy. As I stated in my testimony, it is tremendously important that time be spent on the front end in terms of preparation and pre-employment services to make sure that people are not wasting both the taxpayers' dollars and their time and the infrastructure of employers who hire them so that they match the jobs and are able to do the jobs well. In order to get those kinds of results with this population, you simply have to spend the time up front. To take somebody who's an incumbent worker, as most dislocated worker programs do, and turn them around for another similar kind of employment is a very, very different proposition than taking somebody who has been out of the workforce for 15 years, who is in a crisis, and who does not have a sense of either direction or marketable skill sets. And you can't just turn somebody like that loose in the competitive economy and expect that they are going to end up with a well-paying job with benefits and being a contributing member of a workforce. So, does that address your question, Representative Search?
It does.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Sertich.
Thank you. Just one more final comment. I'm very supportive of this, and I think what we need to look at as the committee, and I think you're absolutely right that DEED is the right place to do this. Is it's a different Minnesota that folks like yourself, ma'am, grew up in, at a place where people sometimes could afford the opportunity for one of the parents, if there were two parents, to stay home and raise a family, and I think that was a good thing when they were able to do that choice. You know, growing up, as I grew up now, we live in a different Minnesota where there's both parents most of the time need to work, there's more women in the workforce, those sorts of issues, but I think we still have a responsibility to the folks that were able to spend time raising their children and staying at home, that if they're widowed, if they're divorced, if they've had different circumstances like that, we can't just abandon them, and I think that's the good initiative of this, and we just have to find, I think, the right way to fund it.
Representative, we do have three other bills before the committee, so if you could very briefly.
Mr. Chairman, I just need to clarify that I read the testimony of a DH participant who could not be here today. I cannot speak on how she financed her training. However, but for myself personally, my primary job and the most important job that I have is to be my husband's wife and my children's mother. And I work part-time now that my children are older for the DH programs. So in my Minnesota, there are still a lot of us women that our primary job is to take care of our children.
Representative Zalka, do you have any closing comments?
I appreciate you all taking the time to listen to this, and as far as, I appreciate Governor Plenty, and he's trying to make his decisions, and we as the House and the Senate also make our decisions, and together we come to an agreement in the end. But so I would like to renew my motion that House File 1536 pass and be referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Thank you. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
So we'll take civil honor. Representative Davids.
You can let it.
Thank you. Representative Davids, I'll move House File what? 524 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I do have a delete all that I'd like to work off.
Very well.
This is the A2, Mr. Chairman.
A2? Okay. With that, I'll move the A2 amendment. All in favor of that motion, signal. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. I think you're where you want to go.
I think there's a...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Today, House File 524 would give money to the Commonweal Theater Company to design and construct a theater center in the city of Lanesboro. You should have, at this point, a handout that gives you some basic background on the Commonweal Theater. Now, for more of you senior members, the first question that I'm getting is, I thought we did that before. And in quite dramatic fashion, we did. Some years ago, this project was funded with $1 million in the bonding bill. What happened was, in the Ventura administration, Ventura had vetoed quite a few different things in that bonding bill. We came back for an override and failed, and from what I understand from former Chief Clerk Ed Burdick, for the first time ever, we came back a second time on an override and were able to override it, and the money was appropriated in the bonding bill. Now, there came up a few issues where the city, basically through bonding, it didn't work. So what we're doing is we're back here for another approach. So those monies went back into the general fund, and we'd like them back, is what it amounts to here. And so that's what we're trying to do here today. I have with me from Lanesboro or the Lanesboro area six people that will give brief testimony to the committee in support of the project. I have with me, I'd like to introduce Mr. David Ruin, President of the Commonweal Board. I'll start with a few remarks. And if we could go through the remarks and then have questions at the end, that'd be preferred. And we'll try and respect your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Give me a name for the record.
My name is Dave Ruin. Mr. Chairman, representatives, good morning. I wish to express my support for this bill this morning from the following perspective. As one who has chosen to return to his native home and raise his family in the community of Lanesboro and Fillmore County, when I left in 1979 to go to the University of Minnesota, we struggled. I was on the annual staff trying to sell advertisements in our high school annual. We had so many storefronts that were closed at that time. I want to also provide a perspective of one who has witnessed the tremendous tourism-based economic expansion that the Commonweal Theater has helped leverage in this community and Fillmore County, and also as a school board member who has seen our enrollment stabilize and has observed the relocation of many families attracted to what makes our community and Fillmore County so unique. But really, this story of rural economic development in Lanesboro and Fillmore County really began with the seed money provided by the legislature back in 1980 when the DNR purchased 35 miles of the abandoned Milwaukee Road railbed for, ironically, $1 million. Subsequent abandoned railbed purchases and paving led to a trail which now reaches south from Harmony to rural Preston and connects into the main bike trail which reaches from Fountain on the west to Houston on the east. From the mid-1980s to the mid-1990s, what I call bike trail tourism was the primary attraction, and bed and breakfast began to flourish during summer and early fall months. The Commonweal Theater Company first began as a summer venue back in 1989 in response to requests from local business owners seeking additional attractions for tourists. Some years later, a Christmas-themed play was added each November through December. This expanded opportunities for area lodging establishments, restaurants, and shops by extending the visitor and tourism season. Let's identify this first phase of economic development as Act One. Shortly after relocating my family to the Lanesboro area in 1995, the Commonweal Theater expanded its performance season to 11 months out of the year. From that time forward, beginning in 1997, economic expansion in the area, as measured by new tourism-related businesses such as B&Bs, restaurants, stores selling gifts, antiques, furniture, and selling or renting bikes and canoes, dramatically increased. It was also during this time when area and local support for the Commonwealth Theater began to flourish. The patronage from Fillmore, Houston, and Winona County citizens has been gratifying on two fronts. It fulfills one of the primary missions of the Commonwealth in providing professional theater art to area residents, plus it introduces new dollars into the local economy, which was previously spent in similar venues only available outside the local area. During this period, 1997 to the present, the Commonwealth Theater Company established itself as an independent draw or venue, independent of the bike trail, and became a destination in and of itself. Additionally, Commonweal began to attract and retain patrons who committed to long-term financial pledges from individuals as far as the ways of Twin Cities, but largely from a 45-mile radius reaching into Wisconsin and Iowa. Lodging establishments and restaurants now have become to depend upon the steady entertainment market segment represented by visitors whose primary intent is to take in one or two plays during a 2 or 3 day stay in the area. By the time the Sanders Family Christmas Play finished this past December, the Commonwealth Theater had filled 17,000 seats, public seats, in 2004. From 1997 then to the present, Commonwealth Theater established itself as a standalone economic engine for the area's economy. Let's identify this period of time, 1997 to the present, as Act 2. Currently, the Commonwealth Theater Company is working on drafting what I'll call Act 3. Even in my role as president of Commonwealth Theater, it boggles my mind that this theater has garnered such critical acclaim regionally, nationally, and even internationally with respect to the Ibsen Festival each February. There is strong demand for limited seating for performances, and unfortunately, too many would-be patrons are turned away on Friday and Saturday evening performances. In effect, output capacity of this economic engine has been reached. A new Commonwealth Theater facility, which would nearly double the performance seating, will grow the entire Fillmore County economic pie by increasing the capacity of theater seats and thereby adding to the sustainable long-term supply of visitors and guests who will travel back to the area again and again to enjoy great theater, area restaurants, shops, local attractions, and lodging establishments. The new facility will enable the Commonwealth Theater to expand programming in explorative ways in the St. Main Theater, which the theater company currently rents and performs in now, and allow the Lanesboro Arts Council to add additional season venues of its own, which will create new demand for visitors and locals alike.
Thank you.
In closing, I would like to thank this committee for your time and attention, and would invite you to participate in Act 3 to help take Fillmore County economic development to a new and higher third level. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman.
The next person to testify is Julie Keeney, Executive Director of the Lanesboro Chamber of Commerce.
Welcome to our committee.
Julie Keeney, Executive Director of the Chamber of Commerce, and on behalf of our Board of Directors, I would like to thank you for this opportunity to express our support for the Commonwealth Theater in Lanesboro. Our Director and Board of Directors recognizes a direct relationship between the activity of the theater and its impact on Lanesboro's overall growth. As the Commonwealth Theater Company has grown from its inception in 89, the new Commonweal will broaden economic and cultural growth in our region. The theater is a major attraction and a regional hub for the arts. As you heard Dave say earlier, 17,000 in attendance in 2004. The Commonweal creates a big city art scene while retaining our small town feel. People come to our area to bike the Root River Trail system, and they stay overnight because of the theater, and they take in Lanesboro's other attractions. With a second and new theater, people would be likely to plan an extended stay to see another production, and these extended stays would directly increase tourism, leading to more dollars spent on local lodging, dining, and shopping. As the Commonwealth works with us in the chamber, they have helped in boosting all of our marketing efforts. Lanesboro has been receiving both regional, national, and international media attention. Examples most recently in the last 2 years, including articles in the Midwest Living magazine. Outside magazine this past summer named Lanesboro as one of the top 20 dream towns to live and play. Also, National Public Radio has featured Lanesboro because of the theater in a marketplace story called Arts and Agriculture. A group tour marketing has increased for us in Lanesboro as the theater offers discount ticket programs, and it's called the Theater with Friends. This has increased the number of groups and tours that have come to our area. Internationally, we also have been noted in the London Sunday Times in a travel section, as well as in the Viking Magazine, which is an international magazine for the Sons of Norway, featuring the Ibsen Festival. This Ibsen Festival has created and expanded our tourism year into the winter season, so this has been a great advantage for our area. Our local businesses, of which I work directly with, recognize the effects of the arts. The gift stores and restaurants, they gauge their customer activity by the theater's schedule. Expanding the Commonweal's main stage so the season would have multiple productions, and this expansion would directly impact our local economy. Visitors flock to our area. They're looking for that different experience, the place for relaxation, for mind stimulation. And our region needs new opportunities and experiences to better the quality of life for our residents and our visitors as well. Your support of this bill will be visible in every restaurant, every historic inn, bed and breakfast, and business that thrives in our region. And we thank you for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next person I'd like to testify is Dave Huizenga, who's the owner of the Haberstad House. Now, I'd like to certainly invite everyone on the committee to come down and see the Commonweal Theater taking a play. And if you want a really nice place to stay, go to the Haberstad House. It's really a great place. So I've got Dave Huizenga here from the Haberstad House.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Huizenga. I live in Lanesboro, Minnesota. My wife Nancy and I have owned the Haberstad House Bed and Breakfast since 2000. We moved from St. Paul to Lanesboro because we were attracted by the friendly people, the beautiful country, the lively tourist trade, and a vibrant, growing art scene. Over the last 4 years, we have become aware of just how important the Commonweal Theater Company is to the region. As you've heard, the theater company has been performing for 16 years. It is one of Lanesboro's largest employers. The Commonweal actors and employees live in the area and are very actively involved in our community and our schools. The well-attended performances of the theater company provide a unique cultural opportunity for the area's students and seniors, as well as all the residents of Lanesboro and our surrounding communities. The theater company has to help support the tourists who come to see the plays and stay for a while. Businesses benefit from this in that many of the visitors to our region combine a bike ride or a canoe trip with a fine dinner and an evening at the theater. Others, especially during these colder winter months, come to Lanesboro just to see a play. We estimate that over 50% of the people that stay in our bed and breakfast attend a Commonweal Theater performance. And because of the nature of our business, we have direct input from these visitors to our area. We hear their comments at our breakfast time conversations, and we are very aware of the quality and the value of Commonweal Theater Company performances. We have hosted executive business meetings in our carriage hall space. The guests invariably want dining, shopping, and recreation options for their downtime and for their spouses. The theater is an important offering for these people and makes a difference in their decision to hold their meeting at our B&B and in Lanesboro. In the winter months, many businesses, including lodging establishments, either closed or cut back on their hours significantly. The fact that the theater is actively performing is critical to our B&B and several other lodging establishments and restaurants that are open year-round. The Midwinter Ibsen Festival draws large numbers to the city, and the large space of the new theater will allow for expansion of this event. Ultimately, other businesses will find winter hours a viable option. Theatergoers are more sophisticated today, and in addition to high-quality plays and performances, they expect modern facilities with comfortable seating. The existing St. Main Theater space is inadequate on all levels. Significant restoration and expansion is in the near future of that facility is not an option. A new theater will bring modernization, classroom space, and increased seating, which means more tourists, more lodgers, more bike, canoe, and kayak rentals, more diners in our restaurants, more shoppers, more people taking Amish tours and carriage rides, all of which adds up to a much healthier local economy. The Commonweal is badly indeed in need of an updated, larger facility. Downtown Lanesboro is also badly in need of new development. It is hard to imagine an economically successful downtown Lanesboro without a successful theater. The Commonweal Theater Company has earned and receives our local support, but we need a little extra help. The company has earned a share of the state's economic development money as well. We urge you to support House File 524.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to now go to Adrian Sweeney, who is an actor and resident at the Commonweal Theater.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much for having me. My name is Adrian Sweeney, and I am a resident company member at the Commonweal Theater Company. I'm here to tell you a little bit about what it's like to be an actor, to live in Lanesboro, and to be a resident company member. I can safely say that the Commonweal Theater Company is unlike any other theater company in the country, at least that I'm aware of, and I've spent a good amount of time researching them. More than 20 additional seasonal company members join the 9 resident company members every year for 6 to 9 months. This is in a stark contrast to the typical theater schedule of 4 weeks of rehearsal, 6 weeks of performance. The extra time that we get to play together, to work together, allows us to grow and trust one another in ways that is very uncommon in the theater community. We continue growing through every rehearsal to the closing show. Indeed, many patrons actually tell us that they come to see our shows several times throughout the course of the run in order to see just how the shows change, deepen, and grow. Being a resident artist at the Commonweal means I get to work with a core group of people who know me. As a performer and a person, as a colleague and a friend, who can and will challenge me to be the very best that I can, to give the very most that I can. The idea of a true resident company is a rare gem in the American theater, and it can be found right in Lanesboro, Minnesota. The atmosphere of trust and stability that is nurtured at the Commonweal flows directly into the community as well. We resident company members and theater members live in Lanesboro, we own homes, and we pay taxes. We teach at the school. We serve on the library board, we're members of the Sons of Norway, we play piano at Sunday service, and we wear funny hats while we read to the elementary school students on Dr. Seuss's birthday. And we strive to make theater and art as accessible to as many people as possible to break down the perceived barriers between artists and audience. Company members do a little bit of everything at the Commonweal, from performing on stage one night to cleaning toilets and working at the box office the next. We wash our hands in between. A recurring comment from our patrons is that they love to see us around. Folks don't hesitate to stop us in the bakery to talk about what they saw on stage the night before, why they liked it, why they didn't. In fact, on one very memorable Saturday, December afternoon, I was running errands in town. Someone stopped me and said, "The show that I opened the night before was the absolute worst show the Commonweal has ever performed." The very next door, somebody gave me a bear hug and said, "Oh my gosh, last night's show was the best show I've ever seen at the Commonweal." And I love that. I love to live and work in a community for whom theater has become second nature. I love that my bank teller sees every show. I love that the little girls down the street still quote the 2004 production of Christmas Carol. Theater has become part of the fabric of the community in Lanesboro. Some of you may indeed have seen the feature article about the Commonweal last month's Star Tribune. One of the beautiful photos features Dolores Wallen, a lifelong resident of Lanesboro and a one-time theater critic. As I thanked her for volunteering, her tug and said, "Oh my gosh, last night's show was the best show I've ever seen at the Commonweal." And I love that. I love to live and work in a community for whom theater has become second nature. I love that my bank teller sees every show. I love that the little girls down the street still quote the 2004 production of Christmas Carol. Theater has become part of the fabric of the community in Lanesboro. Some of you may indeed have seen the feature article about the Commonweal last month's Star Tribune. One of the beautiful photos featured Dolores Wallen, a lifelong resident of Lanesboro and a one-time theater critic. As I thanked her for volunteering her time at the Sons of Norway event, she grabbed my hand, she held it to her chest, and she said, "I want you to know that Lanesboro would not be here without the theater." Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're running short on time. I've got Mark Tyne, the Economic Development Director for Fillmore County, to make a few comments, and then Hal Kropp, who's the Core Artist Executive Director of Commonweal, will wrap it up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mark Tyne from the Fillmore County Economic Development Authority. Thank you very much for letting me come and speak today in regards to this critical project from an economic development standpoint in Lanesboro. It fits our Economic Development Authority focus, and one of those focuses is to support the existing businesses and the existing industries that we already have here in Fillmore County. 80% of your growth, you will find when it comes to economic development, comes from within, and this is a perfect example of how that happens. I'm here on behalf of the Fillmore County Board of Commissioners and the EDA to support this project. I do have a list of things here to go through. I guess I'll give some of my time here to Hal, who's the executive director of the Commonwealth, to express some of his opinions. I'd also like to say that the tourism piece is very strong in Fillmore County, and we do not have a $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 campaign marketing piece to recruit businesses. The tourism piece is one of the ways we work with those organizations like the Commonwealth, like the other tourism organizations, to recruit and get the word out that Fillmore County is a good place to come and create your business in our community. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To wrap it up, the Core Artist Executive Director of Commonwealth, Hal Kropp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Hal Kropp, Core Artist and Executive Director of the Commonwealth Theater Company. I guess in wrapping up, what I would say is that Lanesboro is a town of 788 people. And 16 years ago, before the bike trail opened and coincidentally the theater opened the same day, there were 11 empty storefronts on Main Street. Today, Lanesboro has a thriving, vibrant community. We are economically viable. We have also hit what is known as a plateau. The most you can do to the trail is repave it, which isn't going to bring a lot of people. But the Commonwealth Theater Company, which seats 126 people in their theater, can see 17,000 people in the course of 2004. With a new 186-seat theater, and the old theater still accessible to us, we project that we'll be able to serve, within 5 years, 35,000 people annually. In 1989, when we started, lodging revenues in Fillmore County were $292,000. In 2000, the last year that the Department of Revenue reported it, lodging revenues alone were $3.2 million. If you just do the sales tax calculations, you'll see that an investment in an increase in capacity for the Commonwealth will more than pay for itself. Additionally, we now employ the equivalent of 22 full-time employees. This new facility will allow us to move up to a total of 30 full-time employees, living in the community, contributing back to the community. I find it strange, being an artist and a businessman, sitting in front of this committee talking about economic development for a town of 788 people and talking about a new theater. But I'm blessed, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Park.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe this is for the author. For this $1 million appropriation, is this a privately owned theater, or is it publicly owned?
It's a 501c3 corporation, the Commonwealth Theater, so it's not-for-profit.
Privately owned. I was thinking that we had done something with this in the bonding bill another year, hadn't we done it? Wasn't it? Was it previously public?
We overrode Governor Ventura's vetoes on this and the Guthrie. Right. It took me two times on this one. The Guthrie passed. There, we overrode on the first. That was just sport back then, wasn't it?
Mr. Chair, didn't we then give some money to them?
Yes. We on the second try, we overrode Governor Ventura's veto, and they qualified for the $1 million through the bonding process, but with the strings attached, and it just didn't work out. So that money had to go back, and now we're trying to get that back in a different way through the EDA of Fillmore County has agreed to be the pass-through to the 501c3.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, then, is there a match, local match with this then, or not?
They are going to be raising, and if you wanted to work on some language to do the match language, we could certainly do that. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean,
Representative Westenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, talking to the author here, I'd like to make an oral amendment to this amendment. And I'm recommending doing is on line 6, simply deleting the words acquire land for and the comma. And speaking to the author, because this is already, land is something that they have for this particular project. Also, it's come to my attention, House Counsel pointed out the fact that on line 6, the word Commonwealth should be changed to read Commonweal.
Mr. Chairman, I would accept both of those as friendly. This is, we're not going for bonding appropriation. The land, we can pull the land out of there, and the money be for design and building. And it should be the Commonwealth Theater, not the Commonwealth Theater. So both of those would be friendly amendments.
Okay. discussion? All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment passes. Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've actually been in the theater a couple of times, and it does need to be redone. I mean, it's a delightful show, and it is certainly an added value to Waynesboro. And I fully support this whole idea. I just think that maybe, since how we have the good Representative Davids here, and having seen a couple of plays down there, I've got an idea for a sellout, at least, a legislative sellout. I've got a couple ideas, and we can talk a little later what role he could play down there on stage.
Representative David.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, it would pack the house. And I'll buy the spring roll top for you, too, by the way.
My apologies, Representative Westerberg, I inadvertently cut you off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick follow. As far as assuming that we are able to get this done then, the $1 million, is this the final time that we would see this here? Just as far as are there plans to come back? Is there further expansion? Anything else in the works?
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Westerberg, the answer to your question is yes. It will be the final time we get this done. As far as expansion, they don't really, I guess you could go up, but you couldn't go on either side or out on the street. So, yes.
Thank you. It's been said many times, but I'd recommend everyone visit the city of Waynesboro. I brought my wife down there for an evening at a bed and breakfast. I'm not sure if it was at yours or not, but my wife was very happy. So.
With just that, that alone. Yeah.
Oh, jeez, and I said that on tape, too, didn't I? No.
Mr. Where's the chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Over in Boston, they have the jailhouse.
Oh, boy. Okay. With that, Representative Gunther renews his motion to have House File 524 considered for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill, as amended. Thank you, Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Oh, I'm blushing, really. I didn't know that. good morning, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Appreciate you taking the time this morning. I know the people after me have a lot of testifiers, and so there are three amendments, but they can be very quick. And then we're here mostly for the jobs provision. The three amendments on this quarantine bill are in response to
just to put things in right order. I move House File 1507 for approval and referral to the Public Safety Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The three amendments that you'll be considering, which I can do in the short order, are really clarifying and actually tightening the language up. And so, Mr. Chair, maybe if you would like to move the 346 amendment.
I move the 346 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, this just clarifies that if the commission should order a temporary hold order, that she would have to tell some people, like the governor, the two leaders of the different legislative bodies. We're not sure if it's the president of the Senate or the majority leader, but we're going to figure out who that would be better. But we wanted to get them started, and we'll fix that in public safety if we have to. And then the two chairs. So this will not happen in the dark. So that's a simple intent.
Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the 346 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes.
Did you get it?
The A2 amendment, the next one, Representative Abler?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
The chair moves the A2 amendment. Representative Abler?
Mr. Chair, civil law spent some time talking about how quickly we should get this notice out. Once you do this, we want to read, this should be court review as soon as possible. The next amendment talks about 36 hours being the maximum time that can elapse. This is language that clarifies what the Civil Law Committee wanted to do, and so we argued about as soon as possible, or as soon as and immediately, and this goes back to the immediately terminology.
Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. And finally, the A3 amendment. That's your final one, Representative Abler?
This is, I think, important. And all along, I've been trying to tighten this language up tighter and tighter, and I think that one of the concerns has been that we have people be quarantined for a cold. The line 5 talks about life-threatening diseases, and that's the intent all along. And and this establishes a 36-hour timetable as the maximum time that there is for this person can have a court having ruled, which is really quick, way quicker than in any other process. And finally, it sunsets that section in 4 years.
All right, the chair moves the A3 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and I believe the bill is now in the form the author would like. And again, for members of the committee, the employee protection portion of this proposed legislation is the topic that we'll be referring to today for our jurisdiction.
What page is that, Mr. Chair?
Excuse me, Representative Mullen.
What page is that?
I believe it's page 6 and 7, section 5. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maggie Lighthizer with the Minnesota Department of Health. Section 5 in the isolation and quarantine bill is modeled after language that's currently in place for people who are ordered to jury duty. This would remove a barrier that people may have to either voluntarily comply or if they are ordered into isolation or quarantine to who may have concerns about their job. This would prohibit an employer from discharging or disciplining them for 21 consecutive work days.
Any questions for the testifier? I hear none. We, Representative Abel, is okay if we go to the testifier?
We're done, Mr. Chair.
Okay. First is, and I apologize, Twyla? Twyla Braze. And then, she's not here? Okay, how about, is it Aggie?
Yep.
Oh, that was you, I'm sorry. And Tom Roman? Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Tom Roman. I'm a citizen of Minnesota, law-abiding citizen, and I'm concerned about my civil rights in this matter. Should I proceed?
Please proceed.
Okay, I believe government has a responsibility to serve the common good, promote safety net for the vulnerable, defend human life and racial dignity, overcome discrimination and ensure equal opportunities for all. With that in mind, I wish to focus on comments that relate to my civil rights. One of the things I noticed that was missing in this bill is that you don't really take care of the small companies. Let's say you were the commissioner and I was a small company, which I am. I have a small company, and you detain me for 21 days. That basically ruins my company. I think there should be some provision other than the present language, which just refers to the unemployment compensation, because owners of small companies really don't get any compensation for unemployment. It might say so, but in fact, it doesn't ever happen. Also, I believe that the term believed to be caused, believed to be occurring, should be replaced by the words proven, and so that there's no question as to the illness or evidence that somebody bases their decision upon. I believe that citizens should have a right to immediately respond to any order. With modern-day communications, and here it states that police can act on orders by electronic means of various sorts, why can't the citizen have immediate response rights to such an order? Because some of these things can be mistakenly done.
Mr. Roman, just for a clarification, this committee today is only reviewing the employee protection portion within the legislation.
I thought I was called upon to deal with the whole thing.
That's okay. So do you have any comments pertaining to the employee protection portion of this this proposal?
Not at this time. I want to be able to comment fully on the 1507 though.
Sure. From this committee, if it passes today, it will be going to the Public Safety Committee, and I would assume that they'll be taking testimony at that time, be more pursuant to those topics. Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry I didn't catch the name, but so you're talking about the protections to a small employer
Right.
Could you, I know time is very short, I'm unsure of what your concern was and what the remedy.
Well, I would say that there's a lot of terms in here that says communicable disease believed to be. It's rather vague, extremely vague. And if you go around quarantining or isolating owners of small companies, of which there are very many in Minnesota, you're going to create basically their job destruction. What I'm saying is you have to have some protection more than just somebody believing something to be dangerous. You have to have proven fact. And with present-day technology, you can communicate analyses to various parties that can analyze the diseases and stuff very quickly. And I would say, in general, you need to give the citizen, the small owner, the right to respond immediately to such quarantine orders or isolation orders. You need to preserve the rights of the citizen or civil rights.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
You know, again, as I said, time is very short here today. I will make a promise to you that I'll take a look at this and I'll talk to the author about that. I know you've taken time off of work, and we appreciate that, bringing those concerns. We'll see what we can do. Appreciate you coming here, sir.
Any further questions?
What other opportunity do I have to say further comments about this bill?
Representative Abel will be public safety, correct? The public safety committee will be hearing up this legislation.
Which will happen when?
Representative Abel, could you? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Westberg.
Unless he has any further comments dealing with jobs, I mean, as far as there's anything further in the bill dealing with jobs or small employers, we'd still like to hear that, too.
I beg your pardon?
If there are any further comments that you have as far as referencing jobs or small employers concerning the bill, that might still be appropriate for our committee, and we'd certainly be happy to hear any other comments you have along those lines.
And I guess that was my... Let me make sure I'm answering your question. You don't need to state how this bill would affect jobs.
Correct.
So I'm the owner of a small company, and I certainly wouldn't want to be detained because every dollar that comes in depends directly on me, and if I'm not there, we're done. Absolutely done. And it provides a poor light on the company as well. And even though you might say it doesn't cause any public disgrace, it does. And so I ask you to provide a way to allow citizens, and especially owners of small companies, to counteract with such types of orders, which could be, you know, a mistake. I was threatened with death on the telephone one day about a month ago. Nothing came of it. I went to the police officer. He said, wait till it happens again. Now, what do? Same thing in terms of a job or a project I'm on that I'm involved in. If I get quarantined for no reason and nothing comes of it, you know, I'm dead in the water.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Any further questions for the testifier? Mr. Roman, thanks for your testimony today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Representative Abel, do you have any closing comments?
No, I do just a short comment, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the attention, and I've tried really hard to take into consideration the current concerns of citizens like this and small business owners. Part of the language today was to tighten up safety, life-threatening. It can't just be a sniffle. The commissioner has to think it's going to jeopardize the whole transmission. But I tell you, when SARS or avian flu, which is 70% fatal, happens upon your neighborhood, you're going to want to have people staying in their houses. Mm-hmm. Most people will be asked to stay in their homes and in the place that they would be comfortable in, and just stay home. And then that's all they have to do. A few in Toronto, 30,000 people were quarantined. One person needed a quarter. And so that person should stay home. And this is, maybe we never need this bill. And so if people have specific ideas about how to make it better, you saw three amendments today, exactly what that's about. Please come to me, I'm all ears. Thank you,
Reverend. Thank you, Representative Abel. Seeing no other comments, I renew my motion for House File 1507 to be passed and be referred to the Public Safety Committee. as amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion passes. Thank you. Representative Search, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Representative Tony Sertich, representative from Chisholm, also a law-abiding citizen, I think. I would like to move House File 1569 for possible inclusion in the Jobs Omnibus Bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sertich moves House File 1569 for possible inclusion in our Omnibus Bill. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Plenty of people here today to help support the statewide significance of this bill for community action grants. And I'm going to shut up and turn it over to them because they traveled from all over the place. Just so you know, this is grants and agencies that do really the work that is unduplicative and not and very critical.
Cannot be duplicated.
That's a better way of saying it. That's a much better way of saying it. And I'm going to turn it over to them, shut up, and get out of the way.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Barbara Dory. And I'm the executive director of Coochiching, a community action agency that serves Coochiching and Itasca counties based in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. And yes, it's the famous Grand Rapids that a few of you visited last week on a hearing. We have several people, about six that are going to testify today, but we're prepared to move along quite quickly. So we're really excited to tell you about community action and how important the community action grants are to our agencies. We have 28 agencies in Minnesota, and they're all private nonprofit except one. One is a county base. And then this money also goes to the 11 tribes in Minnesota. There are over 1,000 community actions in the nation. The community action agencies were formed in 1964 as President Johnson's War on Poverty. Some have said that the war was lost, but I'm here to tell you that the war still needs to go on. Our numbers are growing as resources are shrinking. We're seeing more and more people coming to the doors, to our doors. This year we're celebrating our 40th anniversary, and we have some new and innovative programs that we've been working on, and we have people here to testify about that today. One of the major points I want to tell you is that our agencies are locally controlled, and decisions are made at the local level. This is grassroots governance at its best. Our board members are from one-third private organizations, one-third public elected officials, and one-third of people who actually receive our services. And so those are the folks. They're the folks that are serving on the school boards. They're the folks that are going to the churches. They're the folks that are on our streets. And they're the ones who are deciding how this money gets spent. We're able to leverage the dollars that you give. We are now in the governor's budget, and he has not marked it for cutting, but we're here to ask you to reinvest some of the money that was cut out in 2003, asking for a $3 million increase. Our services are targeted to those who are most at need, and this money is also used as seed dollars to help create programming that is determined to be needed at that local level. The seed dollars are leveraged. This community action money comes to our organization, and as an agency, we look at what are the needs of the community. We ask our community members, what are the needs? We then are able to leverage those dollars by pulling in foundation grants, other governmental sources, local donations, so that we can meet those needs. At a time when government resources are shrinking, we're able to identify the needs and bring in other resources to meet those needs in a nonprofit way, filling that gap that the government resources are creating. One example I'd like to give you of an innovative project is something we started in Grand Rapids about a year ago. We started a Circles of Support program, and that is to leverage local resources. We've asked community volunteers to give of their time to form a circle of friends around a family who is in need, someone who's in poverty, someone who wants to get out of poverty. Those community members meet with that person and help them set goals to get out of poverty. We've seen success so far. It's only been going on for a year, but we're also excited that we have received an integrated service project grant from the Department of Human Services that will help test this project with our current MFIP system. And so these are the kinds of innovative projects that we're able to initiate at our local levels with the community action grants. And I'm going to turn it over to our next speaker to tell you more about community action agencies. Thank you for your time.
Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Jason Burak, and I'm here as a board member of Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington Counties. During the day, I work at Bremer Bank, which is owned by the Otto Bremer Foundation, advocating for human rights and social and economic justice. And I'd also like to take this moment to thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for taking the time and the effort this morning to consider what community action grants do for your neighbors and your business partners in Minnesota. Community Action Partnership for Ramsey and Washington Counties, formerly known as RAP, all of you may know what that is, has proven results on a local level. One program dear to my heart is FAME, that's the acronym for Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota. The clients that are able to get into the program open a savings account at a financial institution like Bremer with $40. They deposit $40 a month for 2 years. They attend educational classes about banking, taxes, buying homes, etc. And upon completion, the funds are triple matched. This match is a true partnership brought together with state, federal, and private dollars. The result is about $4,000 that can be used for an education, a down payment for a house, or to start a business. Here's where your neighbors and business partners come in. The dollars are leveraged many times over when a successful FAME graduate moves into a local neighborhood and builds wealth through equity and pride of ownership. Or she might serve your next trendy dinner that the newspaper wrote about, and the proud new owner of the restaurant. But finally, perhaps, she'll get into law school and eventually represent the state on some legal issues. Thank you, and please support the bills to restore $3 billion to community action grants.
Thank you. And, to the two remaining testifiers, our committee is supposed to be over with at 10. We're going to stay here until about 10:05. We do have another committee in this room. It's got quite a busy agenda, so people are going to begin coming in, so if we, whatever you can to keep your comments as brief as possible. Thank you and welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the tape.
You know, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Everett. I'm a Clay County Commissioner. I'm a coordinator of a nonprofit organization called Real Life Outreach, and I'm the immediate past chairman of our Lakes and Prairies Community Action. I want to encourage you to support House File 1569, which would restore so some of the funds that were taken away in the last session. Some examples of the way that our programs are benefiting our community is I handed out two letters from people who would like to have been here to testify but couldn't come. But two programs that I've been directly connected with, as a Real Life Outreach coordinator, we received some of the discretionary funds each year from our local community action to help us with emergency needs for people that we work with. We work with primarily people who have fallen between the cracks, and we are really the last resort for people, in many cases saving their homes by paying utility bills or mortgage payments or whatever it is to help people stay in their homes. And that money was taken away when the funds were cut last time. And we had received only $10,000 from our community action agent each year for that program, but that $10,000 probably saved 20 to 30 people from being evicted from their homes because of the grants that we could give them for some of the important things that they were doing. The other thing that I especially connected with is the county. We had the Lakes and Prairies Community Action ran a child care center in our family service center. And it was heavily subsidized with the discretionary funds that came from the grant, community action grant. And that too had to be closed. And it affected many, many families in our community because that child care center was closed. So these are simply two examples of cuts that were affecting our community because of the cutback in the last session. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the tape.
My name is Deborah Memengay. I'm
from Sherburn, Minnesota in Martin County, and my representative is Bob Gunther. I'm one of the 19,312 low-income persons living in the nine counties of South Central Minnesota. I'm also representing low-income persons in my county by serving as a board member on my local community action agency. I have benefited from services from our agency which have been Head Start for my children, weatherization, energy assistance, furnace replacement, and other home repairs, which have helped me live within my very limited budget. As a board member, we decide what the most pressing needs are in our areas. For example, transportation, making sure there is affordable housing, and having local access to our county offices. Examples of how we use our community action grants is we wrote a small cities development grant for Mapleton and Winnebago, which will bring in over $1 million for these communities. I'm very proud of our agency and have been able to help others as I have been helped. Without our community action agencies, many people would have to do without.
Thank you. And the final testifier, and ma'am, if you could, two testifiers, if we could wrap it up in about, is a minute and a half to 2 minutes, okay, Representative Surge? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jan Callison. I'm a board member for Suburban Hennepin. I'm a public sector representative, which means I also am a council member for the city of Minnetonka, and I will try and be very, very brief. One example of how community action has made a difference in my area of Suburban Hennepin County is through the Community Land Trust has been created to create affordable housing in our community. CASH, the acronym at that time, was original member of the Land Trust Task Force. It was our fiscal agent. It does the home buyer training for the homeowners. It has done training for our board. It also inspects structures and works with us with rehab. So it's made a direct impact in our community. I think even though budget times are difficult and tight, this is budgeting that makes sense in today's world because it works collaboratively with local governments and private individuals and entities, and it creates a system where local tax dollars and local monies are used efficiently. So I thank you for your support.
Thank you very much. And our final testifier, again, please state your name for the record.
My name is Corey Schner, and I'd just like to share with you my experience that I've had with the CAP agency. About 2 years ago, I thought my life was, well, pretty bad. And somebody told me to call the CAP agency, and they got me in touch with my outreach coordinator, which basically put my life together. My children, are in Head Start, and I've been very involved with that. Just between going in and talking to them to figure out a different avenue to do things, as far as getting a job, everything. I mean, it's like a huge support system because I've gotten to know these people, and I actually just met with my outreach coordinator just recently and did like a reevaluation to where I was last year to where I am now. And it's huge. I don't know what to say. I don't know what I would have done without it. So, thank you for your time.
Well, the most effective testimony is always that from people who participate in the program. So, thank you very much for coming. Glad to hear the good news. Representative Surge, in closing.
Mr. Chairman, just wrapping up, you see 5.5 in the bill because this is the base plus the additional funds that are requested, the $3 million, which would bring them closer to where they were before the 53% cut last time. And just want to reiterate again, we can discuss about this when we're building the bill together, though, the local partnerships, the local control, the reinvestment in our communities is very important. And finally, I want to thank Chair Bradley for giving us a few minutes of time with his committee to hear all the testifiers from all of the state. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chair, I just want to say to all the witnesses who came, despite the fact that you were last on the agenda and everything was rushed, I think we know how extremely effective the community action agencies are and how important they are. And the testimony was very helpful, so even though your time was short, we were listening, and I just urge you to keep talking with all your legislators. This is competitive budget this year, and what you do is incredible. And I hope people do get a chance to look at some of the documents here to see what our investment brings us. It's very valuable. Thank you.
With that, Representative Surge renews his motion to have House File 1569 considered for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.